Himalaya.
Hi, everybody. This is Dr. Karen Kelsky of The Professor Is In, and I am here to mention that you can join us over on our premium site of The Professor Is In. And first of all, of course, download the Himalaya app and then subscribe to our Professor Is In podcast. And by doing so, you get access to our premium page where we have conversations and offers and various things that kind of deepen and expand the things we talk about in the podcast and in the professors in generally that you have come to know and love. So we've lowered the cost for the pandemic. It used to be $7.99. Now it's $4.99 because we know people are struggling. So please join us if you can. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. This is Kel Weinhold from The Professor Is In, and I am the productivity coach and also the person who supports you in preparing for interviews and campus visits.
If those ever happen again.
Just introduce yourself.
This is Dr. Karen Kelsky of The Professor Is In, and I am the one who, what do? And my team and I do the editing of your job documents, as well as grant proposals, as well as book proposals. And I also manage the post-academic transition team, which is something that, for obvious reasons, more and more people are coming us to inquire about. So if you've been wondering about your transition out of the academy within the current apocalypse, well, you can get amazing support. So just get in touch with us. You can find us on Facebook at The Professor Is In, on Twitter at Professor Is In, and of course on the website, theprofessorisin.com.
There you go. So if you have joined us for the last couple episodes, what we are actually calling our second season, TPII Podcast 2.0, we are step-by-step, chapter-by-chapter, section-by-section, revisiting Karen's book, also named The Professor Is In, just in
we
case.
We are nothing if not consistent.
Right. The Essential Guide to Turning Your PhD into a Job. And Karen has been contemplating and working with her publishing company around doing a second edition. And we have, since the first edition came out, had an ongoing conversation about what was missing, mm-hmm. What has changed since then. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that we came to understand very quickly is how much of the book did not specifically address issues of, in particular, race, mm-hmm. and how some of the advice has some pretty significant deficits around mm-hmm. that. So we're going through each section. We're talking about it. We're complicating it. Mm-hmm. And today we're going to take up a section that, you know, this just straight up needs to be addressed. Mm-hmm. So,
well, all of them really do in a way. I mean, it was interesting because at first, you know, I sort of flipped open to chapter 5, Stop Acting Like a Grad Student. And I looked at part 1 and it said, you drone on and on about your dissertation. Please stop that. And I thought, well, that is a piece of advice that I really feel, you know, even right now, kind of applies across the board. It is very common amongst grad students, regardless of the subject position you occupy. It is just because it is structural. It's structural because grad programs, PhD programs, reward hyper-specialization and narcissism. And so the further you go into it, the less you can really speak about anything else and the more obsessive you get about your dissertation. And I still think that structurally speaking, that remains a major liability of the PhD training apparatus and one that you should resist when you try to make that transition out into the professional field. And I don't just mean on the job market. I mean, if you were to be at a conference and chat with somebody, that you would also try to refrain from droning on and on about your dissertation. So anyway, I remarked on that to Cal and we had a little conversation and then we went to section number 2. And section number 2 is, you think people are out to get you in your department. And then we looked at each other and I said, well, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean people aren't actually out to get you. This needs updating.
Right. But wait, I want to go back a second because we jumped into the chapter and I want to go back to what you said right before that we got on this about what you want to own about this chapter, what you want to straight up want to say when you wrote this chapter.
Oh, yeah, sure. No, the larger framing, absolutely. The larger framing of it is that I had in mind a normative grad student model in my mind when I wrote it. And that model was unexamined, I realize now. And it was, by and large, it was a white grad student. To be precise, actually, the majority of grad students that I worked with in, if not necessarily my own advisees, but the ones that I work, but the larger community of grad students, PhD students I worked with, they actually were tended to be East Asian because I'm a Japan anthropologist and I was the head of a department of East Asian languages and cultures, and a lot of East Asian grad students came. And when I started my got the endowment, it wasn't a lot. It was a small amount of annual funding to run a professionalization seminar, which in some ways was moving me further on the path of becoming the professor is in. It was overwhelmingly for East Asian grad students in that department. So that is one, and that was not reflected necessarily in what I wrote. But at the same time, if I step back in a sort of more broad sense, I think I probably had, if not East Asian, then a white grad
woman,
student.
White woman.
White woman.
Right.
No, well, I don't know about that. Not sure about that. Not sure about that part.
But the point being, if we're talking about looking what we're doing and how we're doing it square in the eye, this chapter, though seemingly... I was talking about grad students, and when you were talking to that grad student, you made it a normative grad student, which would be
probably in reality probably a white man.
Yeah,
I think
so. So, just from the beginning, then that means that as you redo this chapter, that's going to have to get complicated.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And you know, it's an interesting challenge for an author to think about. You know, when I started The Professor Is In, my shtick was short and punchy and in your face. And I wanted to both not just tell, but also show through my own writing style, how direct and brief and concise a person with a PhD can be.
Right.
And so each of the chapters in this book are only about 5 pages long anyway, because I wanted to just be really, really, I mean, brevity was what I was aiming for, so that nobody could sort of get lost in caveats,
right,
which is what academics love. And then they find ways to rationalize by saying, well, that didn't apply to me, so I'm going to now ignore everything. So now, of course, it's 10 years later. Well, it's not 10 years later since the book, but 10 years since I started this business. And it's like, yeah, I have to add all I do. I have to complicate. How can I complicate without expanding this book, which is currently 400 some pages, to become an 800 page tome?
Right. No, I think it, and I think it remains the challenge. Will continue to be the challenge. And I think it also becomes the challenge of, in particular, continuing to, which I think we have to do. So let me just say this from the beginning. I think this is our responsibility. And we continue to recenter, you know, issues of race.
Yes.
We recenter issues of sexism, of homophobia. If we keep doing that, we know how agitated people who live outside those groups get about having to hear about it.
Yes.
There's a little bit that irritation factor of like, you made your point.
Right.
It's like, no, didn't, because mm-hmm. this is another place I want you to think
right.
about it.
Right.
So I think it'll be really interesting to see what happens with it.
I agree with you. And just to make sure nobody misunderstands me, I am not objecting to writing an 800-page tome. If it 800 pages is what it takes to complicate this in a way that is responsible, ethical, and anti-racist in the ways that I aspire to be, then that's what I'll do. And in any case, I don't think it's necessary. I think good writing will prevail.
Right, right.
I'll keep working on it until it does, I guess, is what I
want to
say.
And I know that we jumped over already that I don't want people to drone on and on. I do just want to just add in that little bit of in fact, people's willingness to listen to you changes based on how they perceive you.
Willingness
to tolerate a white man droning on and on, mm-hmm. and their willingness to tolerate a black woman droning on and on, that the drone actually hurts you more.
Sure it does. And in fact, maybe you don't, because you haven't been allowed.
Right.
So in fact, if I had in my mind that normative white male student and I said, stop droning about your dissertation, it was that was addressed to white men.
Right.
Because they're the only ones, but the ones who are most
given permission
to drone without significant repercussions or even with open encouragement. And then white women would be next and then everybody else.
Right.
So yeah, good point.
Yeah.
Thank you for mentioning that.
So if we go on to this, you think people are out to get you and you think your discipline is out to get you. I think this is one of those beautiful places where we can talk about the culture of grad school and how the culture of grad school does sort of feeds that let's be paranoid that people are thinking and talking about us. Mm-hmm. And we've certainly had enough senior faculty say if they only knew how much we don't think and talk
exactly.
about them. But also in that section can be, but there are definitely people who are not there to support you.
Yeah.
And there are definitely people who are working against you. And that's a very different thing than out to get you.
And there are students who get the brunt of hostility
yes.
and undermining.
Yes.
And those students are 100% going to track along lines of lines of deviation from the white male model that
right.
I inadvertently reified.
Right.
So yeah,
right.
I mean, who's going to be considered problematic is going to be someone, you know, as we know, the way whiteness operates is that white people can defy all the norms and be forgiven, and black people can follow the norms and be blamed.
Right, right, right.
Or, and it can, you know, cast out.
Right.
And punished.
And I think that you mentioned this, but I think, let me see if I can figure out how to articulate this. I think the more you are exceptional in your field, the more that there's a certain undermine. So I'm thinking right now about how last week there was a whole astrophysicist, black astrophysicist,
yes,
right?
Yes.
And how there are just so few.
Mm-hmm.
The numbers are a single digit, I
yeah.
think.
What is that hashtag?
I don't remember.
I can't remember either, and I know it's good. Hashtag.
We'll put it in the description.
It might be black and astro.
It might be.
Yeah.
But we'll put it in the description. So that then that sense of not supporting you, undermining mm-hmm. you. So I do think that there's a weird thing of that way that graduate school makes you paranoid about what's going on, but also the reality mm-hmm. of that experience and that got skipped over.
It got completely skipped over.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact that...
Well, let's not make that passive voice. You skipped it.
Oh, yeah.
It.
I skipped. Yeah, yeah. Thank you. Yeah, I skipped it. I skipped it. I could only skip it if I just didn't really dig into the memories that I have, if I just didn't really delve into my memories and go back to where I started in grad school, where I started in my, after I got my jobs in my departments,
right,
to think about those behind the scenes conversations,
right,
that the faculty did have. Because my overwhelming, like you said when we were talking, my overwhelming sense, the advice I wanted to give quote unquote grad students, i.e. white grad students, was, we're like, we're not talking about you, we're not thinking about you. That is indeed so common. And yet,
right,
whoa, wait a minute. If I really dig into my memories, yeah, we were complaining about this grad student and that grad student, and how often were they the minoritized students?
Right, right. And who were not operating in alignment with whiteness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So, and I think that that's the same way about people are out to get you in your discipline.
Can I say one more thing?
Yeah.
Well, I just realized that I had this, and the thing is, let me try and remember how this worked. At Illinois, the department actually fractured in a terribly traumatizing, you know, very vivid, very big, dramatic way over issues of racism. In this case, it was the Latinx students, and the plaque that we had outside our building for that anthropologist whose name was Oscar, and I can't believe I'm blanking on his last name, but he's the guy who invented the idea of the culture of poverty amongst Mexicans, and basically pathologizing Latinx people as being lazy and therefore poor, poor because they're lazy. And they said, Oscar Lewis, and they said, remove that damn plaque. And that was just obviously, like all these things are, that's just the tip of a larger sustained multi-year, multi-decade state of racism in the department. And I, made my absolute best efforts to be an ally to the students of color who brought issue with that. I remember speaking up very clearly in the meetings. I remember very clearly the head of the department was a Jewish man, and he played the Jewish card. And I told him, no, none of this playing the Jewish card. Like, that gets you out of the privileges of your whiteness and your white maleness. And so there, so all of that is a very vivid memory for me. And I can hold that memory and those convictions, and then at the same time write a paragraph in an advice book saying, you think people are out to get you in your department, and that's like, that's a thing you should stop thinking.
Right.
Like, that's wild. And that's whiteness.
That's whiteness at work,
yeah.
Right? Right, because you can actually compartmentalize.
That's exactly what it was. It's
right.
Compartmentalization.
Right.
So the fact is, it's not, the advice here is that you should stop thinking people are out to get you in your department. The advice has to be nuanced, that people may very well be out to get you in your department. The problem comes when you go into interviews or whatever. Let's talk about interviews with a predominantly white or all white committee. That if you tell a narrative of how people are out to get you in your department, that will harm your candidacy.
Mm-hmm.
But it's okay. But that doesn't mean I can't talk about it in my advice book.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. The next section.
And as you said, the next section is, you think people are out to get you in your discipline, and that would basically be the same thing we just said.
Well, and then I think we need to complicate out to get you, because let's look at Cite Black Women.
Mm-hmm.
Let's look at the hashtag Cite Black Women, but let's look at all the ways that scholars of color are not cited,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
They're not actually brought into a conversation that
right.
they're in.
Right.
And that, you know, I'm sorry, if you're on the receiving end of that, mm-hmm. that's out to get
that
you.
That is out to get you.
That is
yeah.
not, that
oh,
is.
Well, I mean, that was what I was trying to say.
Right. I yeah. know.
Okay, I wasn't saying it didn't apply.
No.
I was saying it does apply at the
right.
disciplinary level.
No, I was moving on from the department, and you were talking about department issues and
right.
then looking at discipline issues.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, those of you white scholars in disciplines, are you actively making sure that you're citing broadly? Are you mm-hmm. reading broadly so you understand
mm-hmm.
the diverse conversations going on? And are you checking your own bias that says I'm not gonna cite that person because why?
And the systems of prestige,
right?
That constantly consider, you know, X person or Y person the most prestigious, most significant person to be cited, and how often is that person the white man?
Right.
Especially as you get into the sort of canonical understandings of your discipline, as opposed to, you know, more topic-centric, like, okay, I'm a scholar of racism, so okay, I'll cite scholars of color. But if I move into, I'm going to write a canonical thing about the methodologies of anthropology, suddenly all the citations are white.
Right.
And that's where that distinction happens, that ghettoization, or and that compartmentalization of the study of race rather than, or settler colonialism,
right,
especially in anthropology, where you view it as not central to the epistemological and methodological foundations of the discipline.
Right.
So,
and
yeah.
And just so, just rather than redoing this or something else, I mean, like editing, whatever, I do want to point out your use of that word ghettoization, mm-hmm, and whether right now we want to be using a phrase like, mm-hmm, that to say people who are pushed over into, mm-hmm, a margin, that word is a, mm-hmm, racialized word.
Yes, it is.
So, yep. I mean,
And you know, if you were, and that's a good catch, because if I were writing that, that wouldn't pass my editing process.
Right. So I.
But it did pass my speaking.
Right.
My speaking filter.
Right.
Yeah. For sure. I wanted to say one other thing. Something that's been popping up a lot in the hashtag Black and the Ivory content on Twitter is also the idea that a bunch of folks, white people who are suddenly awakened to racism, are going to suddenly start writing and speaking and tweeting about racism and then hog all the citations,
right,
again.
Right.
And black, you know, some of the black women scholars I'm following are saying, you know, white people are going to, you know, grab and take credit for and get credit for,
right,
the work that some of us have been doing for 25 years, right, or, right, you know, 50 years or,
right,
yeah.
I think about that all the time in this conversation about defunding police and eliminating prisons. And every single time somebody's like, but what about this? And you think, do you think nobody's been writing about this? Have, mm-hmm, you read Angela Davis?
Right,
I mean,
exactly.
Just act like, mm-hmm, somebody might have thought about it before you,
right,
and then go find them.
Right.
So this next section, you constantly repeat your main point, which you know, I understand that. I understand that people get really myopic about their dissertations and they keep talking about it endlessly. I actually think there's a another thing in here to think about that, mm-hmm, because in talking to graduate students of color, mm-hmm, and especially working with Black women graduate students talking about their work, mm-hmm, there, I wonder how quickly you repeat yourself or you're talking about your thing too much gets, how you get even less room to talk about your, mm-hmm, thing. How it's like,
we get it.
We get
They're
it.
Racist.
Right.
Move on. And it's like, yeah, it's not actually a black and white thing, so to speak. It's not, it doesn't just emerge in one way.
Right. Right. But, and I think that, you know, that in this way, I'm talking about the scholars I know, mm, who are black women who are writing around about issues around race. So, mm-hmm, let's just, that's who I'm thinking about right now.
Right.
And so they're trying to talk about their dissertation. They're trying, right, to bring up critical issues. They're trying to bring up critical race issues. And it sounds like they're repeating their point. So again, right, this is a situation
that
where—
That was what my little thing was,
right,
meant to,
right,
point,
I know,
at.
I
that
know.
If you're studying a topic of racism and the way it works and something,
yeah,
that it's going to pop up in 45 different ways,
right,
and you have to talk about each one of them individually.
Right. Right.
But hostile listeners or resistant listeners are going to say, yeah, shut up already.
Right. So you may sound like you're repeating yourself, mm-hmm, when you've said it twice. And this person said this thing about,
why,
you know,
do you have to keep harping on and on?
Right. You have to keep talking about this. Uh-huh. So I just think, again, you're, let's just acknowledge,
yeah,
that those scholars of color,
yeah,
who especially scholars of color, genderqueer scholars, trans scholars, when your work is around your identity,
mm-hmm,
that the reactivity to your topic is, mm-hmm, going to be higher,
mm-hmm,
than the person who is droning on and on about this equation in, mm-hmm, economics.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems benign, which, mm-hmm, we all know it's not benign.
Yep.
I also think this next section.
You make excuses for yourself.
Right.
Yeah, that's section number five, by the way, if you're keeping track.
My first thought was not if you're trying to, you know, not if you're trying to be 120% because that's what's expected of you. Mm-hmm. Right. Like, I wonder how comfortable, I would really love to know how comfortable scholars of color feel making excuses for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, the interesting thing, though, is I actually conflate two things in this section that I don't know that I noticed before. But the first one is that classic, I'm sorry I didn't get that chapter into you. I got sick over the weekend. I'll have it done this week. I have 102 fever, but it's okay. I'll work through the fever. I'll have it to you this afternoon. That's a certain genre of excuses. Mm-hmm. And then there's the other genre of, I haven't really had a chance to. I'm not sure. I'm not really good at this. I don't know how to do it. And that's a different genre of excuses. Right, I think they deserve different sections.
They do. Maybe they do deserve different sections. But what I'm talking about is I don't know that that's a massive risk to take. Mm-hmm. It's a risk to take.
I'm saying the second genre is a risk.
Yes.
The first genre is probably probably the default.
Right.
Do you understand what the point I'm trying to make?
No.
For students of color who cannot admit any weakness,
right,
because they will be vilified for it.
Right.
They can't make the I'm not sure, I don't know excuses, but they can make the I'm going to write through the pain.
Right. Yeah. Okay. I see what you're doing. Yeah.
That's what I was attempting to say.
But I think that I really haven't had a chance. I haven't been able to do that. I think that, you know, admitting that you can't do something, that you're struggling, that all of those things is an incredible privilege.
It is.
And it is reserved to very, very few.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that I just wanted to complicate that a little bit.
And again, I think that one of the complications that is necessary is that if I am taking issue with what quote unquote grad students say, that it isn't just what you say, it's how it's heard.
Mm-hmm.
Even if grad students in a range of different subject positions had the impulse to say the same thing, because structurally speaking, grad school promotes this overwhelming sense of imposter syndrome.
Right.
And you and I both in our independent ways have worked with Black women who have struggled mightily with imposter syndrome.
Right.
And so to say, you know, but the trouble is your scope is not whether one group feels it more or less. We can also talk about that and why that would happen. You feel like an imposter because you're made to feel like an imposter calling you an imposter. So
because they consider you
an imposter. So like that's a whole other conversation. But even let's just say for hypothetically that a white man and a Black woman both had overwhelming feelings of imposter syndrome and expressed those in some verbal ways in an interview, the rubber hits the road in how they're heard.
Right.
And so that's the complication that is missing time after time in this chapter.
In this particular chapter is just right up front saying the thing that you have to carry through this entire chapter is that you will be heard based on you and the person listening to you. Mm-hmm. So you in the hierarchy of the academy, but also the hierarchy of white supremacy, and your how adjacent you are to whiteness is going to change how you are heard by said white dominant department or culture or whatever. Which, of course, I mean, I just imagine like a whole tens of thousands, not that many people listen to the podcast, but like scholars of color going, duh. Let me just be clear here that I'm not saying anything. We're not saying anything that scholars of color don't already know. What we're saying is that Karen fucked up not saying it.
Right.
Like this is not like, here, let me teach you what you don't know.
Right.
This is, hey, I need to acknowledge this.
Right.
I need to say this is true. So you're not out there saying, that's not true.
Right, right. So that we are not through, that we are attempting to reduce the gaslighting
right.
that the professor is in is responsible for.
Right.
And also, I mean, by the same token, you said the scholars of color can say, duh. And I think that's true. Of course, it's true. But I think that I have also worked with scholars of color who have because the graduate training apparatus is so white and so oppressive, have struggled to find the support of someone saying, it's not you,
right?
It's them.
Right.
And so if there is even one person out there that we can say, it's not you, it's
right.
them, and,
right.
and that's meaningful to you,
yeah.
then I hope this exercise we're doing is
right.
valuable.
Right, right. Yeah, I think that certainly you and I have both had the experience of in on Facebook Live and on mm-hmm. in different more face-to-face engagements of saying, hey, that imposter syndrome, that's because they're treating you like an imposter mm-hmm. because they don't think you belong here. Mm-hmm. You're not making it up.
Right.
That it was created for a particular type of person and you're not it, but don't, that's not on you. So right. anyway.
So number six, you wait for permission.
Right.
Let me, just to be clear, what I was thinking, the example I gave here is my advisor never told me to publish. So I didn't publish because yeah. I was waiting for my advisor to tell me what to do.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that you know, okay, let's just ring the bell again or beat the horse or whatever it is. You cross your advisor. You cross that advice. You do stuff. You do what you're not do, you know, you against medical advice, right?
Right.
There's a different consequence mm-hmm. for different people.
Yeah. But at this and at the same time, I keep going back in my mind to the person, and I actually mentioned her in our last episode as well, but the Black woman who wrote a guest post for our blog, who said that she got to the tail end of her PhD program and discovered that the white grad student in her program had published 3 articles in grad school, and she had published none because she didn't know she was supposed to do it.
Because her advisor failed her.
And what I think about is, here's where this comes, this is where this comes in. Again, well, I mean, it's a repetition, yes. I hope these variations, these slight tweaks are valuable. But basically, the whole reason the professor isn't exist is because grad advisors fail their students.
Right.
They don't tell the truth. They are not sufficiently invested. And these are generalizations and there are exceptions. But as a generalization, PhD training programs do not tell grad students what is necessary to be competitive to get an actual job. And publishing is the single biggest element of that complaint and that failure. And so in a way, this is in some ways, this applies to white men as well, white male grad students. In some ways, they aren't getting the message because nobody's getting the message
right.
because advisors keep failing to give the message. But there are two complications to make to that. The first complication is, yeah, and if a white man and a Black woman graduate with the same program, the same PhD, there is going to be a significantly bigger impact to that lack of competitive record for the Black woman than the white man. That's the first thing. The second thing is that white and male grad students are far more easily hooked in to professionalization training networks because they have a million potential other white male advisors who are invested in their success than a Black woman does, who may be the only Black person in her department and not have any allies amongst the faculty.
Right. And I think whether we have to add the next one is that if your advisor, if your white guy advisor or your white woman advisor has an idea of what a scholar is, has an idea of this is who a historian is, this is who this is, are they reminding that white guy mm-hmm. to publish? And they're not reminding or telling mm-hmm. that Black woman to publish because
right.
they, in their own unexamined experience,
right.
think, mm-hmm. Well, you need to be sure and go to this conference,
right.
but they don't say that to somebody
right.
else. So,
absolutely.
So
I thought that's what I said, but
I thought you were talking about that the advisors may give the same advice, but it will have different consequences, or the students, you know, your classic white male graduate student would just automatically have more places to hook in because, but the advisor themselves may not be giving the same advice.
You're saying, what you said is sort of what I was aiming for,
okay,
which is that the two people could have literally the same advisor.
Right.
And if the advisor is white, they're going to be, you know, very, very likely to be imagining of a provider and professional future for that white grad student that they're not seeing for the black grad student.
Right. Right. Yeah. And again, I'm just going to say this, we're talking, you know, at the range of sort of the range of white supremacy. And we're doing it because, I mean, we're talking about white and black because so much of what happens is a result of anti-blackness.
Mm-hmm.
And that the scholars of color in between, mm-hmm, non-black people of color, as they move closer and closer to whiteness, that there's a different experience. But so I guess what I'm trying to say is we're not leaving everyone out.
We're being binaristic in our conversation today, but that doesn't mean that it's a binaristic system.
Right. And we're being binaristic in our conversation today to point out to just keep driving home the anti-blackness of the experience, mm-hmm, of the academy, of the advice.
Mm-hmm.
So we're taking, you know, that black woman and saying, this person is sitting at the intersections of this place, and this is the consequence.
Right.
So I just wanted to make that clear because I'm thinking, okay, well, yeah, but what about this? Mm-hmm. And it's like, yeah, you're absolutely right.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, all of those variations
are going to apply.
Yes.
And
because we're going to get to this next section, and this is where I think it gets super complicated.
Yes. Yes, it does get super complicated. So the number 7, and this is the last section of this short chapter, is you're submissive. And I end the section and I end the chapter with, seriously, grad students, butch it up. And this is the point where even long, long, many years prior to the current moment, when I would give talks, black women would raise their hands at the end of my talks and say, look, you told grad students they need to not be submissive. They need to be assertive. But what about when you're a black woman and you go immediately into the angry black woman stereotype and you are seen as threatening and hostile and it's going to work against us? Do you have advice for us? And so I need, this is the section, this is one of the sections, but certainly the first, it's only page 45 in the book, where that has to be complicated.
Right.
Not everybody can, quote unquote, butch it up in the same way.
Right. And I mean, I think even the butch it up, which is a phrase that you and I might use very casually, I think then we have to talk about, you know, sort of the anti-femme, anti-woman,
anti-misogynistic.
I mean, right. The whole, there's a whole bunch.
There
of,
is.
There's a whole
it was
bunch.
So funny when I wrote it and I'm so attached to it. I love it so much. And our readers love it. I mean, that one line from this book gets quoted so often with delight. But and me being queer, you know, am I allowed to use it? But then do I have to complicate it? But when you complicate a joke, it's not funny anymore.
Right.
I don't know. That's going to be an open, that's a question I have to ask. But let's not go on to queer stuff. That's not our main
point. No, I'm
going to
stick with this. Because the other thing, and we were talking about before the podcast, is that I think that this particular section, it's important to actually complicate this among different groups of people, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you have black women talking to you about what happens if you do this, I'm perceived as the angry black woman.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've worked with a lot of Asian women for whom the sort of stop being submissive thing becomes incredibly complicated,
mm-hmm,
because as an Asian woman in the academy, you get, it's my experience that people get put in two categories, right? You're either the submissive helpmate geisha type Asian woman,
mm-hmm,
or you're the dragon lady.
Mm-hmm.
And you get to occupy one of those two spaces.
Mm-hmm.
And I work with people a lot in interviews around this about, like, let's just be aware of white fragility and white bias and how you're going to be read,
mm-hmm,
could potentially be read.
Mm-hmm.
So this, you're submissive,
mm-hmm,
is if you change out of quote unquote submissive as an Asian woman,
right.
then you become that sort of dragon lady threat,
right?
Which is incredibly threatening
mm-hmm. to white men,
to white and to white women.
Right, who have decided that you're, you know, safe in a way that is that they think is predictable, and so it's disturbing.
But I also think it kicks off all those stereotypes about you're going to sort of just run over the top of all of us for mm-hmm. your, you know, to meet your goals. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. you know, and then what does it mean for Indigenous women to say, mm-hmm. you know, stand up for mm-hmm. what you think and mm-hmm. what you believe,
and also that, not using the word stand up because that is ableist.
Right, there we go. Yeah. Yeah. So what does it mean for you as an Indigenous woman mm-hmm. to say, I'm not going to be submissive, I'm going to be assertive? Mm-hmm. What's the blowback when that mm-hmm. happens?
Well, you know what I learned, and you do way more interview interventions, obviously. Right. You're the czar of those, and you do them. But I do them. I did them for years and years. Right. I was the right. one who did them, and I still do overflow
right.
even now. So I do them, a number of them, all the you know, every academic year. And what I have been struck by, and I think would serve me very well in my rewrite of this section, is that sometimes when I say don't be submissive, people hear that and they think that means be kind of an asshole. Because in a way, the academy doesn't provide us with a ton of good examples. Mm-hmm. And American society doesn't provide us with good examples mm-hmm. of how to have reasoned, respectful debate.
Right.
I hate the word debate. I hate it. I hate debate. It's like that thing. Reasoned, respectful disagreement. Mm-hmm. And so then they say to me, well, so you're saying I need to do this, and this is my client now, and they'll like reframe it, and they're sort of being, you know, really, they're being aggressive. Belligerent. Thank you. They're being belligerent. And I'm like, whoa, that's not what I meant. What I meant was, actually, I'm going to have to stop you there. That's not what I was arguing. What I was arguing was this. And I base that argument on my research as well as the work of so-and-so published in 2018 and so-and-so published in 2016. Taken together, this shows us that contrary to the common argument, blah, 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 we can actually see it as blah, blah, blah. That's actually what I just modeled right there was what I mean by being assertive.
Right.
And I know that different people will be heard in different ways, but I do at least want people to understand what I mean.
Right.
And I think they usually don't.
Right. Right. No, I hear what I totally, of course, I know you, so I know what you mean. And I do a bunch of interventions, so I know what I mean when I say, yeah. Okay, all right, I want you to own your space. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times the way I put it for people is that I want you to take a deep breath. I want you to put your feet on the floor. I want you to come all the way into your body, not your head, in your body. And I want you to say that again, mm-hmm. completely owning your space. And when I am having those conversations with scholars of color, mm-hmm. That conversation is being complicated on the mm-hmm. individual level. We're talking about, and here's absolutely. This conversation, here's this or that. Mm-hmm. So, but I think it's really important that everybody understand mm-hmm. that we could give you a piece of advice about how to say something, and it is going to be mm-hmm. detrimental mm-hmm. for you to say it uh-huh. as a Black woman.
Absolutely.
Or as an Asian woman, right. or as an Indigenous woman, or as a trans man. I mean, there's going to be this stuff that happens, and so we have to figure out how to talk about this, mm-hmm. saying, we see you,
yeah.
And
I see it as a continuum from the fact that a white man can stand outside his damned house pointing a gun at protesters and not suffer a single consequence. Well, eventually, I guess he kind of got some charges against him or something. I don't know. Whereas a Black, completely peaceful protester doing absolutely nothing, unarmed, will be beaten, if not killed,
right,
by the same group of police, because there is no safety,
right,
and there's no space.
So what this gets back to what I was saying earlier in this whole section, as you bring those different things up, I don't think that most people reading it, most scholars of color reading it, are going to say, oh my God, I didn't realize that. They're going to say, yeah, duh. Mm-hmm. So, or yeah, mm-hmm, yes, that's true. But the
thank
power
you, white
of
lady, for finally catching up.
Well, what I see, I hope that people see in the power of it is that it's our job to, I feel like it's our job to point that out, not to educate you know, Black women about their experience, but mm-hmm. rather to for everybody else to say, look, don't mm-hmm. think that everybody is in this thing operating mm-hmm. in the same space and in the same way. Mm-hmm. And if you're on a search committee or if you are, you know, get that job and you're doing those things that you, that's in your head.
Yeah.
So right. to me, that's the thing.
Because it's that's not gaslighting.
Like, right.
So I need to not be part of the massive gaslighting.
Right.
Also, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, I just want to be clear that I feel like a lot of this is to say, hey, this is not a monolith. This mm-hmm. is not a universal experience. This mm-hmm. is not these ideas mm-hmm. of how to, you know, take your agency and everything else. Yeah, it's great. And you guys know what the consequences of mm-hmm. those things.
Well, and also not going a step further, I have talked to, and I could, as I do this rewriting, speak with other scholars of color and Black women in particular and say, okay, how did you solve this problem?
Right.
Let me take advice from the experts and let me, the advice giver, take advice of what I don't know mm-hmm. and be way more humble about what I don't know, which is one of those things that, you know, white people are one of our very worst qualities
right.
is not being humble about the limits of our knowledge right. and not learning, not being open to learning, not being open to admitting mistakes. So, and you know, we were talking to Dr. Roxanne Donovan and she went into a whole riff about her code switching.
Right.
And how she can sit in a room full of white administrators and get stuff done by speaking in a certain way and dressing in a certain mm-hmm. way. And I would love to go back to her and ask her some more pointed questions about that. And also, of course, managing to do this without imposing on scholars of color and asking for uncompensated labor. Let right. me just say to any of you listening, I'm not, if you, the solution is not to run out and ask your Black colleagues to educate, if you are white, to educate you, but rather to educate yourself.
Yeah. So we have now reached the end of the chapter that I think is pretty funny because at the very beginning when I said, okay, it's chapter 5, you said, I don't know how much there is to do in this chapter.
Let's just,
I mean,
skip
it's just,
right just over.
Like, stop acting like a grad student. And I said, well, let's start reading it. And then right. we started reading it and went,
uh-oh.
Mm-hmm. So I really appreciate not, you know, the fact that we paused and dug
yeah,
into this.
For
and,
sure.
and there was a lot to learn.
There's a lot to learn.
So we're going to say once again, we really hope that this deconstructing this book chapter by chapter is both valuable to you in your preparation for the job market, which I know Karen is very right in that there will be very little, but there is some.
Because of the pandemic.
The pandemic, right. But there are actually searches going on. You're getting, people are doing things. So mm-hmm. we hope it helps you in that, but we really want a conversation about how you're finding this and what even mm-hmm. as we're talking about it, we're missing. So,
yeah. So please do by the way, I mean, I say this in different venues, but subscribe to the podcast so that you have access to us on the platform, the premium platform, because that's where we'll be able to get through to you to see your comments. Because actually, you know, on our social media at large, it's so large on Facebook that sometimes we do miss things.
Yeah, but and I'm just going to be clear. You also don't have to do that.
Of course.
You can talk to us on Twitter.
Oh,
you
yeah.
can email us.
And DM us on Twitter. That's a good way to get in touch with us.
All that stuff. We want to hear from you. So thank you very much. We'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening. Bye.